and anti-fascism, reflections on the past and possibilities in the present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, free improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022, at 9 p.m., La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni Peri Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to This is Palestine. My name is Khadr Jabbar and I'm the Senior Digital Media Manager at the IMU. In this episode, I'll be filling in for Omar Badar as I sit down with Deanna Boutu as she discusses the collapse of the Israeli government and Israel's fifth election in less than 4 years. Hey, Deanna.
Hey, Khadr.
How are you?
I'm great. And how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. So are you ready to dive into Israeli politics?
As always.
So it will be possibly the fifth time in 3 years that Israel will hold elections. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And it looks like the parliament might be dissolved or is dissolved, and you're going to break it down to us now about why that is.
So you'll recall, Khadr, that for 12 years, Benjamin Netanyahu was the person who was the prime minister leading the government. And throughout that time, he had been embroiled in a fairly large corruption scandal. And as a result of this corruption scandal, he found it very difficult to form a government, to keep a government formed. And so as a result, there was an Israeli election back in 2019, and then that didn't lead to the formation of a government, and other elections also didn't lead to the formation of government. And in short, we've seen that over the course of, since 2019, there have been four elections. Now, to be clear, in each of those elections, Netanyahu ended up getting the most number of seats. But in Israeli politics, it isn't just a question of getting enough seats. You have to be able to get enough seats to form a coalition government so that you can get more than 60 out of 120 seats. And Netanyahu was unable to do that in the four previous elections. So rewind a year ago, at the elections that were held in 2021, once again, Netanyahu managed to secure the highest number of seats, but there were so many political parties that were unwilling to sit with him in government because he's probably going to be indicted for corruption, that they ended up not forming a government with him. And this is why we saw in 2021 that there was a new prime minister for the first time in 12 years. And that new individual was Naftali Bennett, who was sitting alongside Yair Lapid, who was serving as the foreign minister. I say this because at the time when this government was put together, this was a government that consisted of the so-called Israeli left, being Meretz, and then the so-called centrist parties, including the Labor Party, as well as the right wing, Yamina, which is Naftali Bennett. And so it was these political parties that came together last year to form a government that has now been ruling over Israel over the course of the past year. Now, many people thought that this was going to be a government that was going to, as they put it, get down to business. But it was very clear from the beginning that there are real ideological differences between these political parties. But these real ideological differences are not, and this is important, they're not when it comes to Palestinians. So one of the political parties that was in the coalition was, for the first time ever, the United Arab List, which is the Islamic movement of the South. They had, for the first time in history, joined the coalition very much against the interests and desires of Palestinians in Israel. And we saw very quickly that their inclusion in the government actually didn't lead to anything positive. So we have seen that this government has collapsed and will now once again be headed back to elections.
And you brought up the Israeli left. Could you expand on the Israeli left? And does it pose any real opposition to right-wing parties, extremist right-wing parties in the Israeli government?
Oh, heck no. So let me describe the so-called Israeli left, and I'm going to also describe how this government collapsed so that you can actually see just how not left-wing the so-called Israeli left is. So the Israeli left, as they call it themselves, is primarily a party that is called Meretz. And Meretz, it runs on a social justice platform. But when it comes to Palestinians, they say things such as they're opposed to settlements, they're opposed to the occupation, they're opposed to annexation, and they believe in a Palestinian state. Sounds okay, right? Except when it comes to practice. This government, since Naftali Bennett has been leading it, now remember, Naftali Bennett is a person who was once the head of the settler council. He's a right winger who very much supports Israeli settlements. He supports annexation. He's actually claimed that he has killed many Arabs in his lifetime and has no problems with it. So under this government, we've actually seen, while Meretz has been part of the Israeli government, we've seen that there's been a higher rate of settlement growth and construction than in a decade. We've seen that homes that Israel has demolished over the course of the past year is more than double what was done under any given year while Netanyahu was prime minister. And of course, what I'm saying is that this is while the supposed left wing was in government. They had the ability to stop it, but didn't. Now, just so that you can see the full absurdity of this Israeli left wing, the reason that this government has actually begun to collapse is because a law, it's considered to be a temporary law that has to be passed every 5 years. Now, just give me a couple of minutes to explain what it is. In 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, including Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. They passed a law that extends Israeli criminal jurisdiction to the settlers, but of course doesn't apply Israeli law, Israeli civil law, to Palestinians. In short, it's apartheid. So what does this mean in practice? Let's say you have two individuals, an Israeli and a Palestinian. And to be clear, the Israeli is a settler. And to be clear, the Palestinian is somebody who's fighting for his freedom. If they were to be charged with any crimes, the Israeli would face trial in an Israeli court, an Israeli civilian court, and would get a lower sentence, whereas the Palestinian would be tried in an Israeli military court, face a higher sentence, and of course be tried in a language that isn't his own. At the same time, the Israeli would be subjected to, would have certain protections, such as the inability of the police to raid his home without an arrest warrant, whereas the Palestinian wouldn't. An Israeli child could only be arrested after they're 14 years of age. For Palestinians, it's 12. And so just this one law is the embodiment of apartheid. You have two sets of laws for different people. One set of laws for Israelis, the other set of laws for Palestinians. Now, the reason that this government fell is that that law that extends Israeli criminal jurisdiction onto settlers, it's classified as an emergency law. And given that it's classified as an emergency law, it has to be renewed every 5 years. And the last time that it was renewed was in 2017, which meant that in 2022, the law has to be renewed. And if not, Israeli settlers are subjected to Israeli military law. Now, you know, you and I can discuss, and we know that even if they're subjected to Israeli military law, that there's always going to be this system of apartheid. But what's important is that the Knesset tries to pass this, gives this level, like this veneer, this facade that somehow things are legal. So sure enough, this bill comes up before the Knesset, and the right wing, get this, the right wing are the parties that vote against this law being extended. Now, they vote that way because they want the government to collapse. But then get this, the so-called Israeli left wing, the left wing that claims that it is against the occupation, that claims it's against the settlements, that claims that it's against apartheid, that claims it's against annexation, that claims that it's for a Palestinian state, they actually vote in favor of this law. And there was one lawmaker who is a Palestinian named Ghaida Rinawi Zarbi. You know, certainly not a champion of Palestinians by any stretch of the imagination. It always boggles my mind why anybody would be in a Zionist political party. That said, she is the only person within Meretz to vote against this. All of a sudden, there are calls for her resignation, calls that she be kicked out of the party, and protests, get this, by the Israeli left wing in front of her house, demanding that she vote in favor of this law. So that's the Israeli left wing. It's a left wing that is in name a left wing, but in practice, when they had the ability to stop an apartheid law, they instead chose to vote in favor of apartheid rather than against it. And what they ended up saying was, you know, que sera, sera, what will be, will be.
Deanna, you bring up an interesting point when it comes to Palestinian members of parliament. Can you speak on the United Arab List and how they play in all of this?
Yes. And that's a really good question, Khaled. So the United Arab List is effectively the Islamic movement of the South. Since 2015, the United Arab List has formed a coalition with the other anti-Zionist Palestinian parties, and they were part of what is called the Joint List. The Joint List consisted of four political parties. It consisted of the Communist Party, also known as Hadash, also consisted of the Jemaah, also referred to as Balad, It also consisted of Ahmed Tibi's party. And fourth party was the United Arab List, which is the Islamic movement of the South. Now, since 2015, they have been in a coalition together, these four political parties, because they agree on everything relating to Palestinian issues. Now, there are some disagreements. There's disagreements between the communists and the Islamists. There's differences. But on the issue of Palestinian rights and Palestinian interests, the four of them are united. What happened in the last election, the one in 2021, was that Mansour Abbas broke off from the joint list and decided that he was going to run it alone. And he ran on a platform in which he said, it's now time for us to join the government. And this is something that the other political parties have been loath to do for good reason. They say that if we join any Israeli government, effectively, we are becoming the agents of oppression. We're going to be the ones that sign off on the establishment of settlements. We're going to be the ones that sign off on the bombing of Gaza. We're going to be the ones that sign off on home demolitions. We're going to be the ones that sign off on the blockade. And they refuse to do that. Instead, their position has been that they will represent Palestinian rights and push back against racist laws, but they aren't going to be part of any government coalition. So Mansour Abbas was the first, it was the first time that that political party joined forces with the government. And he didn't just join forces to sort of prevent the right wing. He actually joined forces and voted alongside the government and actually defended the government at many instances. Now, this, of course, poses major problems. The first major problem that we saw was the tail end of last year, yet another emergency law was being extended. And this is an emergency law that, again, is another racist law. It allows for Israel to prevent Palestinian unification. So if, for example, a Palestinian who holds Israeli citizenship wants to marry somebody who's from the West Bank, from the Gaza Strip, or from any part of the Arab world, that spouse will never be able to acquire Israeli citizenship. It's a racist law. And everybody from Human Rights Watch to Amnesty International has declared it racist. Last year, when this law had to be renewed, we once again saw that the United Arab List was in a dilemma. Do they vote in favor of the passage of this law, which is a racist law, or do they vote against it? And what they ended up doing was abstaining. And then a new law, equally racist, ended up passing, which they voted in favor. Now, this time around, we're seeing yet another racist Israeli law, this time one that is formalizing apartheid. And here, again, we saw a very interesting split. We saw that some members of the United Arab List abstained, and then one voted against. And it's that dilemma that they're constantly facing, that they can't decide whether they're going to be agents of simply abstaining against racist Israeli laws, or if they're going to do something to actually change the system. So here we are now with this government collapsing, and Mansour Abbas, the head of the United Arab List, is once again saying that he intends to join a coalition government because he believes that change can be done on the inside rather than from the outside. And to be quite honest, I think he's wrong. And in fact, this past year has shown us that he's wrong. While he claims that there have been more budget allocations to Palestinian towns, we haven't seen it. During this past year, we've seen just as many home demolitions, not just in the West Bank, but also inside 48 by this government. We've seen that this government has enacted racist law after racist law. And we see that when it comes to actions, Israeli actions in the West Bank, that it's actually been a worse year than it was under Netanyahu's era. We saw that home demolitions went up. As I said, they more than doubled. And we've seen that this is one of the highest rates of settlement growth in quite a long time. So far from him being the tempering force, his presence being the tempering force, his presence has actually pushed the government to do even more, because they have to somehow overcome these allegations that his presence is tempering Israeli action. So, you know, far from being the force that makes things better, his mere presence has made it worse. Plus, they have not done what they needed to do to stop racist legislation.
And Deanna, you just mentioned Netanyahu, a very decisive figure in Israeli politics, even on the right wing. Does this set the stage for a comeback for him?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would not be surprised if he wins once again. They're now trying to pass a law in the last second to say that anybody who is facing corruption charges should not be allowed to be prime minister. It's a big question mark whether that will pass. But Netanyahu has been working behind the scenes with all of the right wing, and I think he's going to succeed. Now, to be clear, Israel is a very right wing country. It's a settler colonial country. Over time, it's only shifted more and more and more to the right wing. And when you see the so-called Israeli left wing and the way that it's behaved during this past year, there's no reason for the so-called Israeli left wing not to join forces with Netanyahu. We're really looking at the only people who are attempting to block Netanyahu and his racist legislation and to try to block and stop the occupation are just those few members of the joint list who refuse to serve in any government with any prime minister.
And what, if anything, does this mean for Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in Gaza?
Look, the short answer, Khadr, is that nothing is going to change for Palestinians, whether those Palestinians are holding Israeli citizenship or whether they are the millions of Palestinians whose lives are affected by Israeli action and who don't get to vote in the Israeli election. That's the short answer. The longer answer is that with each of these prime ministers, what we're seeing is a very dangerous trend, both of normalizing Israeli violence, normalizing settler violence, normalizing the occupation, normalizing the settlements, normalizing the expansion of settlements, normalizing the blockade, and also normalizing this very racist rhetoric that is coming out from each one of these prime ministers or from the political parties that are in the coalition. For example, with Netanyahu, when in his last coalition, he had people in the coalition who had openly called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. If Netanyahu comes to power, he will most likely bring in a man who is a supporter of Meir Kahane, who has not only called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, but who once dressed up as Baruch Goldstein, a man who massacred Palestinians, who massacred 29 Palestinians as they were praying in Hebron at the mosque during Ramadan. He dressed up as him for Purim and said that he, Baruch Goldstein, is his hero. So this is what we're looking at when it comes to these individuals. The short answer is that it's the same and worse, but it's also really important for us to continue to highlight just exactly where these people stand. We are seeing the normalization of the Kahanists. We're seeing the normalization of people who believe in ethnic cleansing of Palestine and who talk about it very openly. And this is the part that's very alarming.
And Deanna, this internal fighting within the Israeli government, is this a sign of any larger issue within Israeli society or the Israeli government? Or is it simply boiling down to arguing over different ways on how to control and inflict violence on Palestinians?
So it's definitely the latter. Oh, definitely the latter. You know, sometimes I step back and say to myself, where are the differences in their political platforms? And the differences are small. They're on some economic issues. They're on some social issues relating to how religious or how not religious the country should be. But when it comes to Palestinians, we're really talking across the board, a wall of consensus that just either denies the Nakba or that justifies the Nakba. A wall, a consensus of people who either full-on support the Israeli settlement movement or who are unwilling to do anything to block it. A whole wall of consensus of people who are either actively pushing for the will to demolish Palestinian homes or people who are turning a blind eye. This is what the Israeli political spectrum looks like. It looks like just one shade or another of ethnic cleansing. You're either doing it or you're being an apologist for it being done. That's it. When it comes to other issues, there's very, very, very small differences, but there is a wall of consensus when it comes to Palestinians.
Well, thank you, Deanna, for explaining and breaking down the circus show that is Israeli politics for us. And if you could leave our listeners with, I guess, one main takeaway from all of this. Is there one main takeaway that you could leave us with? And if so, what would that be?
Yes, there is one takeaway. And the one takeaway is that there is no Zionist left. There can never be a Zionist left because Zionism is incompatible with Palestinian rights. And so the next time you hear about the so-called Israeli left wing, know that it doesn't exist. And that the only people who are pushing back against Israeli settler colonial practices, the only ones who are pushing back against Israeli racism, the only one individuals who are pushing back against, who are pushing to end home demolitions are Palestinians. That's it. There is no Israeli left. So you might hear about centrists and right wing and left wing, and just know that all of them are either right wing or extreme right wing, fascist right wing. And there is no left wing. It's a fascist government that is only being pushed, that is only becoming more and more fascist with time.
100%. Thank you, Deanna. And I guess we'll check back in with you as the circus show unfolds in the next few weeks.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Khadr.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Gucci. Thanks for listening.
سبع ارباع خيو من عين Inconclusive. That's the result of the U.S. investigation into who fired this bullet that killed Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank in May. The U.S. State Department says it was an independent third-party examination and called it an extremely detailed forensic analysis. It continued, concluded that gunfire from IDF positions likely responsible for the death of Shireen Abu Akleh, and it added, it found no reason to believe this was intentional, but rather the result of tragic circumstances. Shireen's family issued a statement saying they were incredulous, considering the numerous witness accounts and investigations by numerous local and international media outlets, human rights groups, and the United Nations that found an Israeli soldier fired the fatal shot.
The investigation, the entire investigation is disappointing, considering the fact that we are not aware of any of the process. We were not, there was no transparency. We were not given enough information regarding the investigation, and we had found out about it last minute. So to us, we still continue to call for a transparent and a just investigation.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also rejected the findings, saying the examination was politicized and had nothing to do with the bullet. Israel's interim Prime Minister Yair Lapid tweeted that Israel expressed grief about her death and that the Israeli army cannot determine who was responsible, but there was no intention to harm her. The Defense Minister Benny Gantz had this to say.
I would like once again to express my sorrow over the death of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The security establishment looks at investigating the truth as a supreme value. Regarding this case, and despite the laboratory examination of the bullet and the relevant rifle, it is not possible to link this bullet to this victim, nor to the rifle. Therefore, unfortunately, it is not possible to determine who opened fire.
The Americans have been putting pressure on the Palestinians for weeks now to hand over the bullet, keen to put an end to this case ahead of the first official visit of U.S. President Joe Biden at the end of next week. Now they can say that they carried out an independent investigation, and despite it being inconclusive, this case is now over. Stephanie Decker, Al Jazeera, West Jerusalem. On May 11th, 2022, Israeli forces killed Shireen Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist and a Palestinian American. But Israel didn't see Shireen's death as a human rights issue. It saw it as a PR problem. And so the disinformation started.
על פי הנתונים הראשונים שבידינו, ישנו סיכוי לא מבוטל שהעיתונאית נפגעה בכלל מירי הפלסטינים החמושים.
But eyewitness accounts and video analysis all point to Israeli gunfire. Here's what we know happened. Shireen was covering an Israeli raid in Jenin, a city in the north of the occupied West Bank. She was wearing a helmet and a flak jacket, which clearly identified her as press. Shireen was shot behind her ear, underneath the helmet, killed by Israeli fire. Journalist Sheda Hanaisha was standing right next to Shireen when she was shot. And it isn't just one eyewitness account. There were multiple people who all said the same thing. But it didn't matter what eyewitnesses said. Israel's goal was to deny responsibility and create confusion, and it did so deliberately by blaming Palestinians. A few hours after the shooting, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett tweeted out this video, saying that Palestinians were firing indiscriminately and falsely suggested that Palestinians were responsible for Shireen's death. And that suggestion then led to many mainstream media outlets creating headlines like these. This isn't just coincidence. The Israeli government knows how to use its statements to manipulate mainstream media. An official even took credit for their, quote, PR blitz, saying they had successfully influenced the Associated Press and BBC's coverage to cast doubt over who had killed Shireen. But here's the thing. According to witnesses at the location where Shireen was shot, Ali Samoudi is another journalist who was shot at the scene. His eyewitness testimony immediately debunked Israel's claims. But the most damning rebuttal came from B'Tselem, a leading Israeli human rights organization. B'Tselem researchers actually analyzed the video shared by the Israeli government. They went and refilmed the location to show that the Palestinians in this video were not responsible for Shireen's death, because there was virtually no way their bullets could have reached her.
I think it's worth pointing out that this propaganda line was propagated by no less than the Israeli Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, Defense Minister, other ministers, and the IDF spokesperson.
It was only after B'Tselem's video that anyone in the Israeli government walked back the claim blaming Palestinians for Shireen's death. Israel's army chief then issued a statement saying, "We cannot determine by whose fire she was harmed." But the disinformation had already gone out, and the end goal was still to confuse and create more headlines like this. Israel demanded a joint investigation with the Palestinians, which the Palestinian Authority denied.
أننا قد رفضنا ونرفض التحقيق المشترك مع السلطات الإسرائيلية لأنها هي التي ارتكبت الجريمة ولأننا لا نثق بهم.
But Israel continues to shift blame towards Palestinians.
מהרשות הפלסטינית לא לעשות שום צעד לשיבוש החקירה או לזיהום תהליך החקירה בצורה שלא נוכל להגיע לחקר האמת.
Israel's military occupation kills hundreds of Palestinians every year. Last year, they killed 313 Palestinians, 71 of whom were minors. Most of them don't get the coverage Shireen's killing has received. But since Shireen was a prominent international journalist, the widespread outrage has forced Israel's biggest ally, the United States, to chime in. Still, the State Department was careful to not condemn Israel, even though Shireen was a U.S. citizen.
Israel has the wherewithal and the capability to conduct a thorough, comprehensive investigation. They've done it before, and we expect they'll do so in this case.
Israel's military now says it's considering the possibility that an Israeli soldier shot Shireen. But here's the problem. Israel investigating itself typically never leads to any meaningful measures of accountability. Like in 2014, when an Israeli airstrike killed 4 children on a beach in Gaza. Israel said it was targeting a Hamas compound, but eyewitnesses said it was just a hut the kids were using to play hide and seek. After investigating itself, Israel determined that it was an accident and exonerated itself from any wrongdoing. Then there's the example of how Israeli forces killed a 78-year-old Palestinian-American man just earlier this year. Omar Asad was gagged and handcuffed by Israeli soldiers during a raid in the middle of the night. He died from a stress-induced heart attack caused by his injuries while he was detained.
They were hitting him, pulling him out of the car, dragging him a couple of hundred, 200-300 meters. They left him dead, and they walked away from there.
So what was the punishment for causing a 78-year-old's death? The commanders of the platoon that conducted the raid were removed from their position and won't be allowed to serve as commanders for 2 years. No jail time, no external investigation, no justice for the victim's family. As some of you know, I'm Palestinian-American, and I've reported from the occupied West Bank for AJ+. I've seen firsthand how Israeli forces target journalists, especially journalists who are Palestinian.
I don't speak Hebrew. I'm an American. Okay.
They are violent, aggressive, and show little regard for the freedom of press. There's a clear, systematic pattern here. In recent years, Israel has increased its attacks on members of the media with virtual impunity. Just 1 year ago, Israel bombed and flattened the offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press in Gaza, alleging that Hamas had used the building to fire rockets. Israel never provided Al Jazeera or the AP any evidence for its claim. Both news organizations denied the presence of any Hamas members in the building. And even when journalists have worn clearly marked protective gear saying press, Israeli forces have shot and killed them anyway, just like they did with Ahmed Abu Hussein and Yasser Murtaza in Gaza in 2018, and just like they did with Shireen in the occupied West Bank in 2022. This story is quite personal because I knew Shireen as a colleague and a friend. For years, I had watched her trailblazing reporting across the occupied Palestinian territories and looked up to her as a role model. I met Shireen in 2010 at the beginning of my career at Al Jazeera and was excited to get to know the woman who had long inspired me and countless others to become journalists. Shireen was kind, loving, humble, and fierce, and she'll be remembered as a brilliant, intrepid journalist who was the voice of the Palestinian people and their struggle for freedom. She put her life on the line for over 20 years to tell their stories, and her death is a devastating loss. Shireen touched so many of us in person, but also by her inspiring example. And the best way in which we can honor her courageous legacy is to redouble our own commitment to report the truth and the reality of life under Israeli occupation.
My name is Lina Abu Akle. I'm Shireen Abu Akle's niece, the veteran journalist that was murdered on May 11th in Jenin refugee camp by Israeli soldiers. On May 11th at 7 a.m., my father called me. He was out of the country. He told me, Lena, check in on your aunt. She's been injured in Jenin. I immediately jumped out of bed. My hands were shaking. I was very nervous. I was very scared. I picked up my phone and I started calling Shirin. Of course, there was no answer. I called her colleagues to check on Shirin and make sure that she's okay. I was hoping that it would be fake news. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Her colleagues told me that Shirin has been injured. She's in a critical condition, and we are trying to get her to a hospital as soon as possible. Probably 2 minutes later, her colleague calls me and tells me Shirin has been martyred. That was the most difficult moment of my life. I don't think it will ever get worse than that. I felt not just sad, but angry. I was furious that I never expected for once Shirin would be the breaking news.
What's the story?
The story is about seeking justice for Shirin Abu Akle. Just over a month since my aunt was killed, justice has not yet been attained. There has not been accountability, not just for Shirin, but to the thousands of Palestinians who've been martyred, who've been killed by the Israeli occupation forces. I am worried that Shirin's death may go in vain, but I am hopeful. I don't want Shirin to just be another number. I don't want her to just be another martyr. We've had enough. For years, Israel has enjoyed impunity. The U.S. continues to provide $3.8 billion of military assistance to Israel, and that's the same army that killed Shirin. We want the international community, we want the United States to carry out an independent and swift, transparent investigation into the death of Shirin. Shirin was a U.S. citizen, she was Palestinian, and most importantly, she was a human being. For us, accountability means an investigation into the chain of command of the Israeli military machine. Inviting Israel to be part of the investigation is not rational, because you cannot be the murderer and also the investigator at the same time. Justice for us is holding Israel accountable. As long as there's no accountability, Israel will continue to commit its crimes. Shirin was an inspiration not just for me as her niece, but she was an inspiration to thousands and millions of young women, young Palestinians who were aspiring to become journalists. She was a role model. Ever since I was a kid, I was inspired by her. I wanted to be a journalist. I remember sitting on our Lego table in my bedroom, borrowing her notepads and trying to read off her reports. My relationship with Shirin wasn't that just of an aunt and a niece. It was more than that. She was like an older sister. She was like my best friend. I reached out to her during the good and the bad. We loved traveling together. We were planning on having another trip to the U.S. this upcoming summer. Unfortunately, that's not possible anymore. Shirin really enjoyed spending time with her, with our family. Every Sunday, it was a tradition for us to go out to a restaurant, have lunch together, and then come back home and have her favorite tea with mint. It was her signature. I don't think I would ever taste tea with mint the same. Shirin loved animals so much. 3 years ago, she decided to adopt a dog. She named him Filfel. Ever since then, Filfel became the most important member of the family. Shirin's relationship with Filfel was very special. He gave her a sense of joy, a sense of happiness, especially after a long day of work. I feel like I'm still stuck the same place as I was on May 11th. I still feel like I cannot believe that this actually happened. It's shocking. I feel there's an emptiness and there's a pain in my heart that I don't know if time will actually heal it. Shirin's legacy is to continue to talk about Palestine, to keep Palestine on the map, not only when a big event happens, but every single day, because every single day there's something happening in Palestine. Every single day someone is killed by the Israeli forces. Every single day, a house is demolished. Shirin tried her best to cover all these stories, and as her legacy, she would have wanted us to continue to talk about Palestine. That's why talking about Shirin is talking about Palestine.
Thank you.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of...
Hello, fellow travelers. This is Jack again. I'm the archivist here at CKUT 90.3 FM, and this is Venus Radio. So I've spent the last 9 weeks digitizing the tape collection here, which consists of about 800 cassettes, mostly from the late 80s and the 90s. So far, I've listened to 165 tapes. I'm in the middle of the K's in the Canadian General section. You might have heard me yesterday playing a bunch of stuff from that collection, and today I'm going to play some stuff that fits Venus's mandate. So this is actually more difficult than you'd maybe imagine, because there isn't always evidence that a band or members of a band are women or queer or trans or gender nonconforming, like on a cassette. And the vast majority of these artists don't have anything about them online. So I've picked ones where it's obvious, and there could very likely be more. And like I said yesterday, only about 38 of the 165 tapes I got through obviously fit this criteria. But the ones that did are great, and I'm going to play some stuff from them. I'm going to play it in more or less alphabetical order, because that's how I experienced it. So it's going to be a little weird, but it'll be fun. I'll throw the track list up on the blog at music.ckut.ca in the next couple of days. And I'm not going to say too much about these songs, but I will just say that this is archival content, so some of it is maybe a little dated. If you remember any of these bands, if you saw them play, if you were in one of them, or if you want to chat or argue or whatever, or if you want to volunteer to help with the digitization, shoot me an email at archivist@ckut.ca.